Morning. We're coming to you at full throttle. That's right. Saddle for battle, people. I think we're going to need to, don't you? Saddle for battle, indeed. I want to thank everyone for joining us. Thank you so much for your belief and your trust in us. We've got listeners all over the country, all over the world, listening live right now from all across Europe. Or it's late, or early, I guess, right? Depending on your outlook. And North America, South America, Central America, Panama. Hello, Panama. Thanks for tuning in. And Canada as well. Got a great listening base in Canada, too. Thank you so much for tuning in. Folks, Greenovative, it's a small company in Florida. They've created a GMAG power cell that produces electricity by adding salt water to the unit. You can watch the commercial during our breaks. The newest development of Greenovative is the Super GMAG battery recharger with replaceable magnesium power bucks. GMAG, Super GMAG charger will charge 6 AA or AAA rechargeable batteries in about 3 hours, over 20 times per pair of power bucks. You got to see this product, man. It's great. You don't need the sun. You don't need the wind. You don't need the hand crank. All you need is a little ordinary table salt. 2 teaspoons is all. A little water. Shake it for a few seconds, and the unit instantly makes electricity. I should have paid more attention in science, man. Using magnesium as a power source, just adding salt water makes power instantly available. Folks, you got to see this. Super GMAG charger is affordable, lightweight, weighs about 8 ounces. It's durable, EMP proof, environmentally friendly. It'll just put a smile on your face, even when you don't have one. That's right. Super GMAG charger. Well, I'm just kidding about that. It's going to provide a convenient and safe power for recharging 6 AA batteries off the grid or when other power sources are not available anywhere, anytime, in any weather, day or night, folks. Go to HagmanReport.com, Hagman and Hagman.com. Click on that link to Greenovative. That's right. Grab yourself. This is a necessity for your prep supplies, your bug out bag. I have a feeling that we are going to need every prep we can get our hands on. Greenovative. That's right. Super GMAG battery charger. Go to Hagman.com. Click on the link directly to Greenovative. Do it today.
We have with us a first-time guest of the Hagman and Hagman Report. His name is David Thomas. He is the author of several books. We're going to get into some of these tonight. He is the author. He is an author of a number of books we have right in front of us. Called for Life: How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us Into the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic, as well as Seal of God. And one of the ones that we're going to be focusing on tonight is Remember Why You Play. David Thomas is a senior writer and sports columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, a lifelong Texan and graduate of the University of Texas at Arlington. He lives near Fort Worth, Texas, with his family, his wife and children. David, it's great to have you on the Hagman and Hagman Report.
Great. Appreciate you having me.
Oh, we appreciate being appreciated.
And I'll give you a break from talking politics and debate. How about that?
Yeah,
sounds good.
Very welcome.
You've got some good stuff. You've got,
thank you.
And this is amazing, folks. Well, you know what? I'm going to, Joe, go ahead. Folks, listen, because this guest, I mean, well, you're going to be amazed. But by the end of his appearance, you're going to be saying, wow. Like I was.
And let's let Mr. Thomas get into it. Where do you want to start tonight, Mr. Thomas?
Not on the debate. How about that? I'll make a little pact with you. I'm about talked out from that today, and I heard you last hour, and I think you're kind of tired of it too by this point. So we need something cheerful. Let's talk about some good stories, I guess. Which book would you like to discuss first? I think Seal of God might be a good one to start with. That's a that's a very interesting book, very interesting story.
I especially love, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's, I don't want to say my favorite, but if I could pick one out to start with, yes. Let's start with Seal of God.
Okay.
Now, you've worked with just an interesting variety, number of authors, and I'm sure you've taken
quite a mix.
Oh, you have. But I'm going to let you, we're going to let you start. I mean, from a book standpoint, you know, this is, well, describe the book. Just go ahead and start, and we're going to interject where we feel we should. How's that?
Okay. Yeah, I wrote this book with Chad Williams. He is a former Navy SEAL. He has a really fascinating story. He grew up a little daredevil, willing to try anything, didn't mind getting into trouble. And he made his goal to become a SEAL. And the short version of it, and we can come back and pick up the details, but the short version is that he made it through BUDS, made it through Hell Week. He got his trident, became a SEAL. And while he was in the Navy SEALs, he became a Christian, completely turned his life around instantly. And that created a little bit of trouble for him. He had some problems with some of his brothers who didn't like the fact that he had converted and were kind of afraid that the things they did after hours would get told. And so he had to pay a little price for that among his brotherhood. But he did stay in the SEALs for a few years. He served time in the Philippines, and I'm trying to think where all he was. I know he finished up in Iraq, and he's in Saudi Arabia some, but he did time in Iraq and in Fallujah. He was actually in combat there. And he stayed in the SEALs and just felt like because of the life change that had taken place that he needed to go a different direction in his life. So when his time was up with the SEALs, he got into ministry. He's associated with Greg Laurie in California. So that was the pastor that preached a sermon in which he decided to give his life to Christ. And so since leaving the SEALs, he's become a speaker, traveling around, talking to different places, churches, military functions, Memorial Day, Veteran Days, all types of things, those types of events. He is, as a lot of SEALs are, he's about 150% when he does something. He doesn't tap the brake very often in his life. And once he became a Christian, his 150% was completely toward God and sharing the gospel message of Christ and trying to lead as many people as he can to make the conversion that he had made.
You know, one of the things I liked when I first picked up the book Seal of God, the subtitle, The Path is Narrow and the Reward is Great. This, of course, Chad Williams with David Thomas. We're talking with David Thomas, the author. The first sentence I read, God shapes his men with the hammer of adversity and the chisel of discipline. How true is that?
Yeah, and, I think you probably lived it, I'm guessing. I think most of us have, yeah.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Now, just to be clear, this is a story of a tough, rough and tumble young guy. I'll let you tell the story about Chad Williams realized his dream of becoming a Navy SEAL. I mean, and as you said, man, you know, he did. He went through the training. He made it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, so. And he grew up. I guess you'd call him an unfocused kid. You know, he wasn't quite focused in class, and he liked to be mischievous and get out and cause a little trouble and have a little fun, I guess, a little mischievous fun. But he didn't really have a direction that he was headed. And, you know, again, being 150% or nothing guy, once he decided to become a Navy SEAL, that was it. I mean, that was what his life completely revolved around. And he was able to hook up with Scott Helvenston, who people may not recognize the name, but in 2004, he had been captured in Iraq and burned and hung from a bridge in Fallujah.
And folks, remember that. Mr. Trump, I apologize. I just want people this. You know, if you don't remember this, when I was reading this book, when that came up, I remember this. I remember seeing these images on television. They were only on briefly, but that was of U.S. Navy SEAL Scott Helverston. He was brutally murdered in this ambush in Fallujah, on the streets of Fallujah. Now his buddy Chad, of course, he was committed to, you go ahead and continue. But I just, again, folks, remember that name. Go ahead.
Yes, Scott had become a mentor to him before he went and went back to Iraq. So as Chad was making this his dream to become a SEAL, Scott was the person who took him under his wings, helped him through the training, because as you well know, the physical demands to become a SEAL, much less be one, are incredible. And so he had Scott Helveston, one of the, you know, a SEAL to many people, helping him physically and mentally prepare for that. So as he was training, Scott went back to Iraq, and Chad turns on the TV one day and sees those images of his mentor hanging from a bridge, body burned, and just, you know, it's even, as a person who works with words, it's hard to describe the emotion that stirred up within him seeing his mentor like that. And so he became bound and determined that whatever it was going to take, he was going to make it through SEAL training. And he entered in his bud's class. He was one of 173. And of that class of 173, 13 made it straight through. And he was one of those 13.
Yeah, and he went on to serve on SEAL teams, what, 1 and 7, I think, right?
Correct, 1 and 7, yes.
Yeah. All right. And he went through tours of duty in the Philippines and Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and, mm-hmm. as you had mentioned, of course, in Iraq, finally. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And folks, this is a great book. Again, the book we're talking about is Seal of God, Chad Williams with David Thomas as the author. So, go ahead, sir.
Sure. And actually, just a little aside, one of the interesting things about this book is, you know, you see the title and you hear what it's about, and you think, you know, this is a man's book. And when the publisher, Kendall House, first got the manuscript in and started working on it, the first group of readers they put it in front of happened to be a group of women, and they loved it. The publisher's blown away because they were thinking this is going to be a book that would target the male audience. And I've been surprised, too, even still today, how many women just love this story. And I haven't figured out why yet, but there's something that just connects. It's not just a man's book. It's the stories in it, I think it does a lot of good to see a tough man come to Christ and have his heart softened. And that really comes through in his book, to see the complete life change that he undergoes once he does become a Christian. And that's, you know, that's really what the story about.
Yeah.
God changed him completely.
And it's interesting how you describe, and one of the fascinating things I found, and you don't find this in too many books, is the description, the detailed account, the level of specificity with respect to Hell Week, mm-hmm. during SEAL training. I had no clue what went on, you know, and my goodness. So, yeah.
It makes you tired reading about it, doesn't it?
Well, you know what? It gives me a newfound respect for our men and women over there, but the SEALs especially, and what they... I went through that. One of the questions I had was, I wonder how much that training is worth, you know, dollar-wise. And I know that's a weird question, but my goodness.
Mm-hmm. That would be interesting to see how you could put... I don't even know how you could put a dollar figure on that, because... You know what they do for our country. You can't put a price tag on it. They give everything.
Yeah.
You know, and they are willing to go and do whatever it takes to defend our country and defend freedom.
That's true.
And they're trained to do that. I mean, that's their mindset. That's their default mechanism, is to give up their life if need be without thinking.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, you continue on your path, because you know, I'm interested too of what your takeaway is. From this book, and you know what stuck with you and such. And go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned the Hell Week, because that was something that the publisher really wanted to focus on. I mean, you know, there's quite a big market of SEAL books out there. So you got to find what separates you from the rest. And you know, first of all, being a Christian was one thing, but in their research, they determined that there wasn't really told a lot about Hell Week. And that's a great mystery to a lot of people that really want to know what it's like. And it's interesting. It's a week of sleep deprivation. They get just a few hours of sleep the whole week. They're put through unbelievable physical training. They're out in the surf in San Diego in the cold water. They're brought in and out. They're brought back onto the beach. They get all sandy. They get back into the water. They're in and out. They're running miles and miles and miles. They're told to run, not how far. So it's just an incredible week that just breaks them down completely to themselves and brings them to the whole of the body of what they're trying to do as a group. And that is when most people quit. You know, there's a lot talked about the bell.
At the instructor, and the instructors are urging the people, why don't you just quit? Go ahead.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Oh, yeah.
Well, if they can make you quit there on the beach, then they'll know that you would quit when your life's on the line. So it's best to weed those people out then, you know, because that's why, you know, only 13 out of that large number of 173 made it, because it was that difficult. And, you know, like I said, there's a lot of talk about the bell. When you've had enough, you ring a bell, and then you're done. And it was fascinating to hear him talk about the people who had just had enough, and they were cold and shivering and hungry, and they would give up their life's dream of becoming a SEAL and ring the bell just for a can of warm ravioli. I don't even want a warm can, you know, a can of ravioli. But to give up your life's dream for a can of ravioli tells you how difficult that it is.
The mental stuff that they put, you know, these people through, it's just amazing. Wave bye to the sun. It's going to be a cold night, guys, you know? It struck me. It's insightful. It's just insightful into this whole concept of SEALs, what SEALs are, and what builds, you know, what creates a SEAL. And I can see too why SEALs, if you are a SEAL and somebody says, yeah, I'm a SEAL, and they're not.
But it's one of the really intriguing things to me as a Christian, and talking with Chad about all the detail and stuff, is, you know, there are spiritual applications that we can take out of his SEAL training. This concept of not quitting. You know, the Christian journey is not easy. You know, we face a lot of adversity. We go through a lot of tough times. And one of the things that really stuck with me was Chad talking about how he would make it through. And, you know, for runners out there, you know, you see a target in a distance, and you run to that. And then when you get to that point, and you see another target in a distance, and you run to that. And that kind of helps you, chop up what you're trying to do into sizable bites. He reached a point in his training where they were doing these, they call them mile runs, but they're actually multiple miles, and they don't even know how long it will be when they start. He would go one piece of seaweed at a time. It got so bad, it was a target on the horizon was too far. If he had to make it to there, he would quit. But he would look for the next piece of seaweed on the beach and run to that, and then he'd find another piece of seaweed just, you know, a matter of yards away and run to that. And, I mean, that is something I've taken back to my spiritual walk. When things get really tough, you know, and we don't see where we're headed, and we'd have no idea how far we're going, how, you know, until our circumstances get better. But, you know, God really wants us to take one piece of seaweed at a time with him, and to trust him, and to take that one step, and he takes it with us. And then we find another marker he will take us to, which another marker and another marker, until, you know, our circumstances are where we're hoping it would have been a long time earlier. But God is wanting us to depend on him, and just, if you're doing it one step at a time, you have to rely on God. You know, you have to depend on him. And that has stuck with me. When this book came out in 2012, and that is something I still apply in my life today, just that concept of one piece of seaweed at a time.
You know, everyone, folks, if you're listening to this broadcast, you know, some people were going through regular basic training. Others are going through SEAL training. We can apply this to our lives, as you said, Mr. Thomas, and we have to look at it as such, because I used to, and sometimes I'm not comfortable with the statement that God doesn't give us more than we can handle. Okay, I don't necessarily like that statement.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah.
For a lot of reasons, but when you look at it, you look at what we're all facing, because I can guarantee you, everyone listening to this broadcast has got challenges in their lives. And some are just overwhelming, or so it seems. If you're listening to this, folks, and the challenges that you face are overwhelming, Yeah, one piece of seaweed at a time, one step at a time, and we can all get through this together. And this story is inspirational indeed. And again, Seal of God is the name of the book. So what happened to Chad, the conversion? You want to get into that, or where do you want to go?
Sure. If I can backtrack for 1 second,
sure.
If you don't mind, yep. I just want to make one more point from what we were just talking about, because it continues what you were talking about. A Navy SEAL learns that he is created to be much more physical and much more mentally tough than he realizes. That's what training is about. It's about taking them to beyond what they thought their own limits were. So when they're in action, they don't think they have a limit. And I think that spiritually, we really sell short how God created us. We are much tougher spiritually than what we think we are. It's amazing how many times we might want to quit if something that really isn't that big of a deal when we're out of that circumstance and we look back on it, you know, hey, that really wasn't that bad, you know. So I think there's a lot to learn from SEALs, too, spiritually, from the fact that God made us to be tough spiritually. You know, we are all to be warriors spiritually. We are to be, you know, Gideon was not a warrior, but God called him one. He didn't know he could be one, but he became one. And I think a lot of times we don't realize how God sees us. He might be calling us warrior when we don't feel like one, but when we stick with him, we become one. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be taken from this of what is God really calling us to be that we don't think we can be, because he has made us to be much tougher than what we think we are.
Yes, he has. And too often we put restrictions on the Lord and what he's able to do for us, and we find ourselves limiting our own selves when he can make significant progress through us if we are open, if we are willing, and if we, you know, show up for the battle and dedicate our time to his will being done in our lives. And, you know, we've seen and talked about this on the show many times about the Christian culture here in America. And one of the things that's pretty disheartening, you know, in our line of work, we get a lot of backlash, people complaining, this and that. But surprisingly, the majority of it, the vast majority of it, is Christians tearing down other Christians. And somehow we fell into this in a bizarro world where Christians are the biggest heretics in many cases. And that's that spirit of you know, religiousness that is running rampant through the church. And with the churches not doing their jobs in order to, well, the people aren't doing their jobs, the churches are enabling that lack of spiritual growth. And we have the perfect storm that we see today that is allowing even Islam into the Christian religion. So we are just seeing a deterioration morally and doctrinally of the Christian church and the congregants that attend those churches.
Yeah, we really are. And it's unfortunate because, again, this is, we are not being what we're created to be. You know, we were created to be so much more than what we are right now. And we're just falling short of what God wants us to be.
Yes, we are. Mr. Thomas, we only have about 2 minutes before the break. We have, again, your books that you were so gracious to send us. We have Called for Life, the story about the Ebola, Seal of God. And in the third hour, or in the next hour, we are going to get into, you're going to bring on a guest, Jordan, and we're going to get into the book, Remember Why You Play. And I'm really excited into getting into this. And in the next segment, I hope we can get into Called for Life, the story about the Ebola doctor that you wrote this book about.
Sure. And I'm glad it's an interesting story.
Yeah, it is. And again, we want to thank John Robertson for setting up this interview. We got 2 minutes before the break. Any thoughts that anywhere you want to lead us off into to begin this next after the segment?
I'll wrap up with Chad real quick, and because I think we started to go there when I interrupted and took you back a step. Once he became a SEAL, you know, his brothers turned on him within the brotherhood, and he suffered physical abuse and almost was drowned because he was a Christian. And, you know, that's just case in point that when you become a Christian, doesn't mean everything is going to get easier. He paid a price for being a Christian for a little bit, but he came through it. He got closer to God because of it. You know, he obviously survived. But you know, being a Christian doesn't guarantee things are going to be easy. We should expect adversity, and I think in the next segment we'll talk about someone who experienced that with Dr. Brantley and the Ebola that he contracted.
In about a minute, though, why the backlash? Because of his Christian faith. Why?
Well, before he became a Christian, he was out partying with his brothers, you know, when they were off duty, and they didn't stop, and he did. And so they were concerned that he might turn on them and report them, or they just didn't trust him anymore. They thought, if you're a Christian, you become soft. So if we're in the battlefield, can I trust you to save my life? Or are you going to shoot somebody?
Gotcha.
So there were those concerns of, you know, him telling what they were doing. Also, can they trust him in the battlefield? Because, I mean, sure. You have to trust your brother when you're in that situation. And he's, you know, later he would ride on the top of a Humvee shooting a .50 caliber as protection. So you got to know that guy is someone you can trust. And
right.
And, you know, has your back.
And he experienced many, many, many things as a SEAL in Iraq and other countries as well. But my goodness, the story, you got to read it, man. It's just tremendous, folks.
Again, we're talking with David Thomas, a senior writer and sports columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, a lifelong Texan and graduate of the University of Texas at Arlington. He lives near Fort Worth, Texas, with his wife and family, and he is the author of several books, very inspirational books, that tell stories among a vast number of issues in great detail. And we're gonna come back with David Thomas and get into the meat of some of these books, specifically in the third hour, Remember Why You Play, Faith Football and A Season to Believe. Right after this, stay with us.
Special guest, Mr. Dave Thomas. David Thomas, author. In addition to a number of other things, very colorful history, filmmaker as well.
Yeah, and two of his 11 books are New York Times bestsellers.
You know, it's just think about that. Having a New York Times bestselling author on the Hagman and Hagman Report. How great is that? Well, hopefully everyone got a chance to listen to the segment with Dinesh D'Souza yesterday. What a great segment that was. Dinesh D'Souza, what an interesting man, of course, and then Carl Gallup's following that. But certainly, folks, go to yesterday and go to the 19th, October 19th of Hagman & Hagman, and listen to the segment with Dinesh D'Souza. But now we've got Mr. David Thomas on the line talking with him. Joe, I'm going to kick it back to you.
Yeah, we're talking with Mr. Thomas about a number of his books, Called for Life, Dealing with Ebola, Seal of God, and what we'll get into later, Remember Why You Play. If we can, Mr. Thomas, in this segment, get into what happened in last year with the Ebola crisis and how it is that you got involved in this.
Sure. Dr. Kemp Brantley was he and his wife, Amber. He's a doctor. She's a nurse. They were missionaries to West Africa, specifically to Liberia, and they were there before the Ebola breakout hit in Guinea and then spread to Sierra Leone and Liberia. So they were there working with Samaritan's Purse at a hospital there in Monrovia, and like I said, they were there when the Ebola outbreak happened. And he's quite well known, contracted Ebola while treating a patient. He's still not exactly sure how he got it. He's got it narrowed down to a couple possibilities. But he was actually in charge of training for how to handle these type of diseases and how to stay safe and and keep the medical workers safe, and he actually contracted it himself. And as a lot of people know, he was flown to Atlanta, to Emory University, where he was administered an experimental drug that was actually started while he was in Africa, and it was completed while he was in Atlanta. And the drug did work, and he survived Ebola, and he became kind of the face in the United States of Ebola because he was the first high-profile person to get it and the first to controversially be flown back to the U.S. to be treated. And he was just throughout, as he recovered and started doing press conferences and appearances, he was just highly praised for being a man of great respect and great compassion and just an example of what God would probably want a medical missionary in Africa to be. And so he received a lot of attention for how he handled things, because there were people who didn't think he should have been brought back. But as I watched the news and I saw just, you know, he handled everything with grace and dignity and compassion. And he made a full recovery. And he and his wife are still working with Samaritan's Purse. They're not missionaries overseas right now. They're based in the U.S. helping out Samaritan's Purse. They were quite generous to give them some time to kind of get their family back together and get things back to normal from what they had to endure. But their heart is overseas, and I haven't talked to them in a few months, but at that time they were still seeking God's will and hoping that it would be an opportunity to go back and serve people in a country like Liberia. They can get there or somewhere similar where people just need medical help and their medical conditions are just not what we in the United States think they should be, would be kind of shocked to experience. So I got through them. They had found some connection to my agent, so that's how I got with him. But an interesting, kind of little funny part of that is, as Dr. Brantley was giving the press conference, his first press conference in Atlanta after he was cleared, I was watching with my wife, and she said, "You need to write Dr. Brantley's book." And I'm like, "Yeah, right, that'd be great, wouldn't it?" And then a few months later, they're on the phone with me asking if I would write their book. And
How do you do that? Do you cozy up with the, I mean, I don't want to. Sorry, man. I'm not. You know, you guys got Ebola, and okay. Well, how do you? I mean, seriously, how do you do that? Why do you do that?
I believe that he was completely healed. He's a medical doctor. He's not going to do anything that would put anyone in harm's way. So, I shook his hand and, you know, visited his house 4 or 5 times. They live actually. Live pretty near me, so we're able to visit quite a few times. And no problems at all. I had no qualms at all, although I was a little concerned that there was one day right after the first time I interviewed him, I kind of had a little fever and had a little upset stomach. I'm like, oh no.
Oh great.
I knew it wasn't anything major, but the thought did enter my mind, what if something happened? But my bigger fear was actually going to the doctor and saying, have you been around anyone with Ebola? Dr. Brantley. And so I knew I would have been quarantined for a month or something if I'd have said that. So I was hoping the Advil would take care of it and I would have to go face that situation, and it did.
Well, yeah, and he made, of course, Dr. Kent Brantley made news. So, folks, I mean, you'd have to be living under a rock not to remember that. When was that? That was back in
July of 2014 is when he was when he contracted disease, when he was diagnosed. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. And and again, he's a guy, the American doctor with Samaritan's Purse, and you remember him. He contracted Ebola, folks, in Liberia. He became the first American to return to the United States, treated for the disease. People looking like, you know, really, we're gonna bring this guy back. And but perception's a little bit different than reality, isn't it?
Quite a bit. Yeah, quite a bit. And you know, I trust our medical research, you know, to not expose us to something like that, especially for, you know, one individual. I know, I enjoy a good government conspiracy just like anybody else. They're fun to play with and stuff. But, that thought does enter your mind, you know, are we doing the right thing here? And I remember thinking that, you know, I wasn't opposed to bringing him back, but I remember processing in my mind, you know, is this safe? You know, is this what we need to be doing? And obviously it was. And because of that, they've been able to raise awareness of Ebola I mean, that's their heart's work, is to raise awareness of people in different countries who don't have what we have and need help. I mean, they're just right. compassionate people.
And ladies and gentlemen, just to be clear, he, along with other medical professionals involved with treating Ebola patients, became Time Magazine's Person of the Year back in 2014. And now he also gave the invocation at the prayer breakfast, I believe, for the White House, right?
Yes, he did. Yes. Point.
Okay. All right.
Yes. Yeah, and he even shook President Obama's hand. So if the president can shake his hand, I think it's safe for me to shake his hand too.
I won't go there sneaking, but anyway, yeah, it's a little levity there. Okay, all right. So yeah, I mean, it's so this is a kind of a remarkable. Now, as a writer, though, you kind of have to assume the persona in a sense of the person you're writing about, right? I mean,
yeah, when you collaborate with someone to tell their life story, you have to try to as much as you can to walk in their shoes, and that was difficult in this case. It was fun, you know, doing it with a Navy SEAL, because then I got to be big and tough and, you know, macho kind of guy. But when you have a disease that is not treatable, or at least we don't believe is treatable, and you think you have a death sentence, and you picture your wife an entire country away, you know, so I had to put myself in that situation and imagine what it, and one of the really cool aspects of this book is, although the majority of the story is told by Dr. Brantley, Amber also tells portions of her story while she was back in the United States separated from him. You know, so I kind of had to live in both shoes of what it would be like for my wife to be separated from me while I was probably dying.
What was she thinking? I mean, I got it. And folks, again, you know, we're talking about people that, my goodness, imagine yourself in this position. But what in the world was she thinking back here in the U.S.? He's over there in Liberia. Not exactly the place to be, I wouldn't imagine, you know.
So yeah, what was she, medical conditions are tough. She was thinking a lot. She had, you're talking about a lot of responsibility. She had just flown back with their two kids, young kids, just a few days earlier, or she would have been there when he contracted the disease. So first of all, she was glad that they had left to get hurt, you know, so that the kids weren't exposed to it. I mean, it was just a matter of probably a week, I believe. He was supposed to fly to the United States in a couple of days to join them for a family wedding, and she had come back a little early. So first of all, she was relieved that the kids were not exposed to the virus. So she's got the kids here in the States that she's responsible for. She's concerned about her husband, and what was kind of fascinating talking to her, you know, she's a nurse. You know, so not only was she missing her husband, she wanted to take care of him. You know, she has that caretaker's heart. She's just a really sweet, caring person. And so not only was she separated, but she could not take care of her husband. And that really affected her as much as anything else, to think that he was there, being cared for very well by capable doctors, but that she couldn't be there and be one of the caretakers for him.
Yeah, that would be tough, you know. I mean, yeah, I'm not sure I'd handle that situation well. No, what's your biggest takeaway from this? Because again, you're looking at folks. You're looking. Understand this. I mean, here's a guy that made headlines, the international headlines, and you're writing about him. You're writing about the situation. What's your takeaway from this one?
The big word with the Brantleys is just compassion. First of all, compassion took them there. I mean, when they went, Ebola had not, well, he had only heard of Ebola, you know, just in training for extreme diseases, you know. He had no association with it any time at that point. So when they went there, Ebola wasn't present, but it became present, and they stayed out of compassion for the people. You know, he knew that they needed the medical training that he had received. He felt that he was quite capable of helping the people. And one of the things that really, really moved me in talking with him was, and he would tear up quite often as we talked, but, you know, with an Ebola patient, it's tough because, I mean, it's a really cruel disease. It just, you lose lose all control of your bodily functions. You get this, you know, horrible fever and a lot of pain that comes with that until you don't die from Ebola, just something in your body shuts down because of Ebola. So maybe cardiac arrest or some kind of organ failure or something. Ebola doesn't kill you, but it kills your body, and then something in your body just shuts down. He wanted people to die with dignity. They're quarantined in this area where all the medical workers are completely covered in material, you know, to protect them. Their wrists and ankles are taped up, you know, so nothing can get through a sleeve. They're wearing hoods and masks, and so all the patient can see is their eyes and right around their eyes. And so these patients in Liberia are in there with no family. Family cannot get to them. You know, they have to be separated from people. And all they have are these medical people who aren't even the same skin color as them. They're definitely foreigners. And so it really hurt him to see people dying alone. And so he would sit at a bed with someone, and again, you know, two layers of gloves and fully wrapped up, and hold their hand, just so that when their time did come, they could be loved by somebody. They could be touched by somebody, even though it wasn't skin on skin. There was some kind of contact that showed somebody did care for them. And he saw his mission at that point, when he couldn't do anything medically, as just to show Jesus to those people.
Man, that's amazing. I got to ask, I know NBC, I think it was NBC, I think they did an article or a story on this. What cured Kent Brantley, and you know, what cured him? I mean, how? What cured him?
Mm-hmm. That's actually a very interesting question, because he says God healed him, and he received a lot of criticism for that because he did take the experimental drug ZMAP. That just so happened to be in another country near there, had been sent for someone who was high up in the government who had Ebola, and he thought it would be not look well to his country people if he was taking a drug from outside the country, from, you know, a Western drug. So he chose to die instead of taking the ZMAP. And then just because it was there, they were able to get some to Dr. Brantley and get him started on it while he was in Liberia, and then finish it in the U.S. So, you know, he talks about it. I can't wrap it up for you in short, but he talks about this in the book in rather good detail about how he definitely believed God healed him. And it's through ZMAP. It's through the doctors who cared for him. It's through God's touch. He can't give you the exact way that God healed him, but, you know, since he recovered, he was able to spend time with the researchers who came up with ZMAP, and they told him about all the little things that went into making it to where ZMAP even came into being. I mean, the number of tobacco plants that were available to make it, you know, and just how many they happened to have left over from an experiment they were doing. And so he saw God's fingerprints many, many places that led to him being healed.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to see that. And I, you know, I'll be honest with you. I remember the story. I remember the discussion about him coming back to the United States, first person to do that with Ebola. And I remember thinking to myself, man, this is not a good idea. I'm sorry. You know, and I have to say that. I'm thinking of my family. I'm thinking of my welfare, you know?
And I had some of those same questions, too. I don't know if I actually reached a decision or not. I don't remember reaching one, but I remember thinking those exact same things. But he flew to Emory University. That was, if any place could handle it, they could.
All right. Well, okay. Yeah, and I guess, I mean, but just the whole fact of getting him over here and,
yeah.
You know, everything associated with that. I remember thinking, not with any degree of specificity, but thinking, man, this is just such a bad idea. And thinking, well, how, the word I'm looking for is, I don't know, how irresponsible. It's more than that. It was just, you know, how poor of a decision this is. But again, you're looking at God's hands in this, and that's what you document. You document a lot of this, a lot of the things that can't really be explained either, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
And there's nothing wrong with not being able to explain everything.
No, that's true. I mean, and so this story.
Explain everything. Yeah, if we could explain everything, we wouldn't have a very big God, would we?
No, that's true.
Not at all.
I don't want a God I can fully explain, because that's not much of a God to me. If I can comprehend everything about him, he's not God, you know. That's just something equal to me, and I don't want that.
No. But, man, you did a great job in really conveying the essence of the story. And folks, you know, yeah, no problem. And folks, you know, the story itself is an amazing story, but to read it in the fashion that was written is enjoyable as well, inspirational too. You know, we have to have wins like this. That's kind of my thinking here. When we talk about all of the crap, crud, junk, you know, the bad news, the World War III on the horizon, the headlines that are just so dismal. You got to have some good stuff here. You got to throw into the mix some good stuff. Man, this is some good stuff. So, you know, it's very good. So,
yeah, leaves people with hope.
Yeah, indeed. And if this guy can, you know, if Dr. Ken Bradley could overcome what he did, and then the relationship between him and Amber, the kids. Oh my goodness, you know, just thinking.
Yeah,
they are
an incredible family. You know, I remember, like I said, watching him on TV and thinking, that's a great guy. And, you know, I've been in the positions I've been in journalism and writing books. I've worked with some well-known people. And, you know, sometimes they are what you think they are. Sometimes they're not. With the Brantleys, they were better than I thought they would, than I hoped they would be. They were just gracious people. And I want to give them credit for one thing, you know. I've written 11 books, and 9 of them are this type, where I've worked with someone to tell their life story, and I've never worked with anyone who put as much work into their own book as they did. They worked diligently. They wanted it to be an excellent work, and that's why it turned out as well as it did, because of how hard they worked on it, from the medical details to the expression of compassion they have. Their thought was, you know, we're going to write one book, and you know, this needs to really glorify God. And that was their purpose in writing the book. And, I mean, they did Colossians 3:23 throughout the process. They worked very hard, and the end product showed it. And, like I said, just amazingly gracious people. And you look at them, you want to treat them like a superstar for how they conducted themselves under difficult circumstances. But they would push you away from doing that. They are so humble. And I don't use that as a cliche. They're just very humble people who appreciate what God has done in their life, not just with Ebola, but just the fact that they're married and how they got together and the fact that they got to go do missions overseas and help the people of Liberia. Just they have it, probably as much as anybody that I've spent a lot of time with. This is close to the hardest crisis I could imagine people having.
Well, he revealed, by the way, like a near-death, I don't want to say near-death experience, a near-death ordeal, and that's not too many people can actually recount something like that, a near-death ordeal. Man,
Mr. Thomas, we have about 5 minutes before our top of the hour break, and next hour we're going to be talking about your book, Remember Why You Play. If you can you give us a synopsis or an introduction into what we're going to be getting into next hour, what this book
sure.
is about?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that hour. Remember Why You Play is my baby.
Yes.
I love, you know, people say, what's your favorite book you've written? And this is it. I hate to really pick out one, but this was my first book. It was just the way it came about was just a God idea to do, and the dominoes that God put in place for the book to actually get published are really incredible. And what the book is, it's the very short version is it's a Friday Night Lights for Christians. You know, Friday Night Lights was a book about a large public school in Texas, about a football program there, and how the community and the parents kind of negatively impacted that team. Well, this book is the opposite of that. It's about a very small private Christian high school here in Texas, but they're trained by a coach who teaches life lessons through sports, who views sports as a great great competitive arena, but ultimately is second to being a platform for ministry. And so everything that he does is intentional to teach life into these kids. He wants to win football games, obviously, because he's in Texas and this is Texas high school football. But his ultimate goal is to develop leaders and fathers and husbands that are going to make an impact in the world when they go out, wherever they go in their world, whatever their corner of the world is. He wants to train them for that. So what I did was I followed a team called Grapevine Faith Christian School. It's here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. The school of about 300 students in the high school, about 800 kindergarten through 12th grade. And I followed them for the 2007 season. And just did the whole Friday Night Lights thing, follow them and wrote about each game and wrote about the life stories the coach imparts throughout the season. And then in 2008, while the book was trying to be sold, a very special game happened. I know we'll talk about that in detail, but just to kind of tease that a little bit, it was they played a football team from a prison school. And this is a team that has no fans. They're not good. The kids who play are the cream of the crop within the prison population. They had to earn their right to get off campus to go to a football game. The particular night they played, they had 14 players was all they had. So they're outmanned every week. They had no fans. The only fans they have are the school volunteers and the guards who come, which may be 15 to 20 people. So they play every week on the road because they don't have a home stadium. So they go on the road, they usually get beat bad, and they have no fans. But they do get to leave campus and play, you know, experience a Friday night of Texas high school football. For this particular night, when Faith played Gainesville State School, is the name of the prison institution, the coach set up ahead of time to have the Faith fans become fans of the Gainesville State players. So that included a run through tunnel before the game. So they ran between the Faith fans. They had a little tear through banner. They said, you know, Go Tornadoes, their school nickname that they'd never had before. And then about half the fans sat on the home side and half the fans sat on the visiting side during the game. And they cheered for these Gainesville State players. And it's just an amazing night. The ramifications are still felt. We'll talk about that next hour. It's just an unbelievable night of something that does not happen in sports, and especially in Texas high school football.
Yeah, to recount that, and folks, you're going to want to hear this, because this was one of the most inspiring, uplifting, and incredible stories I've read and heard. And you're just, wow, it's just an amazing, so stick with us. And again, these are life lessons. These are inspirational stories. These are things that should grab your heart and interest, and oh my goodness, it should make you feel good. Folks, we're talking with author Dave Thomas. If you want to, the best place to, I'll tell you what, just go to his Amazon page. That's David Thomas on Amazon. And of course, you can get it, we have it linked off of Hagman and Hagman.com as well. But he's the author, co-writer of 11 books. Can you believe that? 11 books. He's a collaborator. Now, I'm not going to say ghostwriter, but collaborator.
It's about the same thing, but close.
Yeah, you know, and your background is as a sports writer. Started at age 13. Go figure. 6 years at the Dallas Morning News, 15 years at Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and where he was a senior writer and columnist. Of course, he left the journalism business in 2011 to write, and his day job is a writer. For an international ministry. We'll just leave it at that. It's interesting indeed. Folks, we're going to be right back. Hagman and Hagman Report. Join us on social networking, Hagman Report on Facebook, at Hagman Report on Twitter, and of course, Real Tech Eric. Spread the tweets. Be right back.